Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find several speaker feeds with over 800 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Colleen. Yay.
Hi, good evening. My name is Colleen. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater.
Hi, Colleen.
And it is always a privilege and an honor to be of service to this program, which has saved my life. Thank you, Andrea, for asking me to speak. Just to start to qualify, I've been abstinent, next Friday, August 4th, will be 21 years abstinent. My top weight that I know was 311 pounds. I've been maintaining about 165 to 170 pound weight loss for probably about 19 years now. And I'm passing around my pictures. And these, for those of you who heard me speak before, these are my size 24 jeans that I could barely fit into when I first came into this program. But I wouldn't go out and buy a size 26 because that would be like reality. And they come with the accoutrement of the insides wearing off because my thighs rub together and things like that. And the fact that that doesn't happen today is a complete miracle. Welcome to the newcomers. This is a great place. And it's okay if your head's spinning because you haven't been done. You know you're in the right place. You know, it's funny when I think back to my very first meeting that I came into. The woman who was the speaker was an anorexic, and I thought, yeah, not eating is not my problem, lady. But, you know, it's not a disease of what we do with our food. It's a disease about our thinking, and that we place the thinking before our thinking mind before our heart mind. And, you know, what I did know about that was that it was a very welcoming place, and after the meeting, she volunteered to sit and talk to me individually. And she said, I know my story isn't yours. She's like, but keep coming and you might hear your story. And she said, you know, check out like 6 meetings before you decide if this is for you. And that was the best advice she ever gave me. You know, and that's what I did. And after about like the third meeting, I was like, oh yeah, I think I belong here. as if my weight wasn't evident enough to me, or the fact that like, you know, the things I did with food, I just thought only I did. And all these people were talking about it. And I was like, how did they know? you know, my path to get here, I came in my late 20s, was long and winding and pretty miserable and horrible, mixed with elation and excitement and lots of confusion and really just a lot of meandering and wondering and thinking, like, did I miss something? Like, maybe I missed out when they passed out the rule book. Like, I mean, I had the standard rule books. Like, I grew up in a religious tradition. You know, I knew, like, here's how we operate, that kind of thing. And I had a relationship with a higher power, but I just, like, that food thing, I just didn't get. And really, actually, to be honest, for me, it wasn't the food thing. That really, the food was not the problem. The food was my solution. The problem was that I was fat. So my solution, you know, if I had thought about it logically, was causing me much more pain than it was worth. But in my mind, it was still worth it, you know. And I probably had several moments of bottoms or like bottoms before I even came into these rooms. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times after a night of binging and I'm laying down in bed and just praying to God that like this would all end somehow, or I could wake up tomorrow and be skinny, because in my mind that was the solution, because that was the thing that people always pointed out. You know, like, you have such a pretty face, if only, right? I mean, I'd be a rich woman if I had a dime for every time somebody said that to me. And, you know, it was always, like, my favorite was people who, like, would talk to you, like, or maybe it was just my mom. Like, I didn't know I was fat, you know. Why do you think boys would like you better? Do you think I haven't thought of that? Like, you know, really, oh, my God, you don't say. You mean, like I, as if I didn't hear the whispers in the hallway in high school, or I didn't see the glance and then lack of a glance, you know, and I wasn't an idiot, you know, and this, of course, was why exactly I would make fun of me before you were making fun of me, because you were thinking about me, weren't you? Because I was thinking about me. you know, and just all those other sort of maddening ways of living that I had just adapted to, you know. And in a lot of ways, while this probably sounds really, really strange, I'm very clear that I am such a hardcore addict that if the food had not worked, I would have gone on to harsher things. I'm pretty sure I would not be standing here today. I'm the kind of, you know, bore bottom compulsive overeater that if the food had stopped working, I would have been looking past alcohol, past something else, because certainly if I could have shot it up, it would have saved me a lot of time. I mean, all those drive-thrus and all that time in the grocery, I mean, all those places I would have to stop to get to before I could, like, sit and know I'd be okay for the night. And then, oh my God, hallelujah, that, like, you know, this is before, like, internet ordering, although that seemed to come into place, I think, as I was heading out, as I got into program. But, you know, like, that you could just call and somebody would deliver stuff, you know. It was like, then you wouldn't even have to go out, you know. And then, you know, the strange comparisons I would do. Like, I remember once watching this movie about this woman who was a bulimic, and I wasn't a bulimic. I thought I wanted to be a bulimic, because I thought, well, that, again, would just, because the body thing, like, that would solve the body thing. Like, it would never show up. It would eventually show up. Otherwise, I have a sponsor who's a recovering bulimic, and, you know, some of the stories she tells, I'm just like, wow, you know. And, it just points to the degrading and demoralizing places this disease will take us to, you know. And that's one of the things that, you know, I love in the literature on chapter 3, which is called More About Alcoholism. And it points out really clearly what my biggest problem usually is, even in recovery, which is the idea, because it'll sneak in there every once in a while, that, like, someday, somehow, I'm going to be a normal eater. And it says that's the great obsession of every, you know, compulsive drinker, of course, in this case, compulsive overeater. And so, like, it's sneaky, it'll get in there. And it shows up in, like, strange ways. Like, how come, like, people can sit around at a potluck and there's this whole table of food over there and everybody's, like, actually paying attention to the people there? And not only that, like, people, like, leave food on their plate and think nothing of it. And I'm like, oh my God, they're going to throw that away, you know? Or it was funny because once I heard, these two women who were recovering alcoholics were talking about how a friend of hers would get a drink and she would just sip it and, like, it would sit there. Now, that's the kind of drinker I was. But I totally identified. She's like, oh my God, what is she doing? I mean, that was like somebody with a piece of cake. And I'm like, how do you not consume that in one fell swoop, you know? And then, like, want the whole cake. But, you know, things like, you know, when I'm still, I'll sit at a potluck and that'll happen, and I'm just like, right, because they're normal, right? You know, or sometimes I'll bring my own food, and my staff, who's a bunch of foodies or whatever, will be like, why do you do that? I'm like, just easier. They're like, huh? I'm like, never mind. They don't understand. It's okay. They don't have to understand. I just need to understand, you know? And, or, like, if I'm going, you know, I'll never forget when, years ago, my sister got married, and I was the maid of honor at her wedding, which was such an honor. But, like, I'm calling and talking to the caterer, like, so what are you serving? Like, how, you know, and asking questions, because that's what I do, because, you know, I'm not going to just walk into something blindly. I mean, there's things that happen and that, you know, everywhere I bring God with me, but, like, I'm not stupid enough to think, like, oh, whatever, you know, it'll just be fine. Like, I'm sure they're going to take care of me, kind of thing. So, because my goal today, when I go to things and I engage with people, is the people and the interactions, not about the food. So the less I have to think about it, the better. And, you know, all of these things are things that I learned in program. When I first came in, you know, I couldn't even imagine, like, the things, like, I saw people in the rooms who'd been there for years, and I thought, like, you live on some other planet, because I don't even know what you do. I don't know, like, it was like my whole life revolved around food, and it was so revolved around food that I didn't even know it was, you know. It was just my way of being, you know, that, like, I knew what every stop was, you know. I live in the valley, and I used to, like, hang out on the side of town. I knew where all the McDonald's and all the other things were on the way back home, because, don't you know, I can't drive home. I mean, I'll never forget the first road trip I took and was, like, didn't think about, like, all the places I was going to be able to stop on the way up there. And I'll never forget. My friends would be like, why does it always take you so long? I gotta go to the bathroom a lot. You know, which I do. But that's another story altogether. TMI. I know. I'm sorry. But anyway, so, you know, all these things about my way of living. And, you know, maybe if I'd had a perfect life, I don't know anybody who's had a perfect life, but, you know, like, yeah, there's some stuff that happened, but there's stuff that happens for everybody, and I just didn't have the tools that I needed, and what I'm really grateful for is that living the 12 steps gives me the tools that I need, you know, but in order to work those steps, I need to be free of my allergy and my obsession of the mind. So that means that getting my alcoholic foods in order. So for me, my abstinence, and for those of you who are new or going, I don't understand what abstinence is, okay, just keep coming. For me, it functions in two ways. It is both acknowledges the food on which I'm completely powerless over. So those would be my alcoholic foods. So for me, that's things like sugar, high quality, I don't know how high quality ding-dongs are, but high concentrations of basically anything aside from fruit. Sugars kind of thing, and, you know, anything pretty much that is breaded, stuffed, deep fried, you know, you more processed, the better kind of thing. Those are certainly my alcoholic foods. And then for me, even if I'm not eating those, what I'm eating all day long, I'm never going to be present. So I have 3 meals a day. So there's time in between. And you know, the expression people use in this program is life in between meals, you know. And in the beginning, that was really, really hard. It was really hard. You know, I had to do a lot of praying, a lot of writing, a lot of, all the steps, a lot of calling, a lot of going to meetings, because I didn't think I was going to survive between breakfast and lunch. And, you know, just because I've been living this way for such a long doesn't mean that thought doesn't occur to me. You know, I can be at work and things are stressful or I have a lot on my mind and breakfast will end. I'll be like, wait, when's lunch? You know, oh, God, you know. But that's okay because the thing is I go, oh, right. Well, what that tells me is that maybe there's something of emotional impact that's going on that I'm not even aware of. And so the food is no longer a signifier. I'm thinking, oh, I need some food. It's what am I feeling? Or what do I not want to feel, you know? Because feelings are big, and they have physical experiences, and they're a little overwhelming, and apparently I was overly emotional as a child. You know, I was apparently Sarah Bernhardt. She's some black and white actress who's very dramatic or something. Apparently I was like that. But I think I just had lots of big feelings, and I didn't really know what to do with them. And, you know, they just overwhelmed me. And, you know, that continues today. The thing is that I've learned how, through the process of the 12 steps, through prayer and meditation, things like that, to do things like I think things and I go, wow, that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing, you know. I mean, I got that from the room. So people clap and be like, thanks for sharing, whether they really were grateful you shared that or not. But I would say that to my own head, you know, especially when it'd be like, you know, what we really need right now, oh, wow, thanks for sharing, you know. So when I came in, again, I was pretty beaten down, you know. I was still a little afraid of, like, what you were going to ask me to do with my food, but my first sponsor helped me establish an abstinence, which in the beginning was just the 3 meals a day. And that really, to be honest, was like 3 binges a day. But it had a beginning, like I would look at the clock when lunch began and be like, okay, I need to be done in an hour. It never took me an hour. But like it was the idea that like there was a frame around when I ate. And then eventually she was brave enough to say, you know, I'm noticing, well, what do you think about like not having sugar for 30 days? And I was like, I honest to God, the only thing I can attribute to my willingness at that point was that I had been in abstinent about 6 months, meaning I hadn't been eating between meals. I was going at the time to about 3 meetings a week, and I think stuff started to seep in. And, you know, I think also from the fellowship, like just seeing the hope, you know, and the sense that like I really wasn't going to have to do this on my own, like that was a very foreign concept to me because most of my life I felt like, well, I'm just supposed to figure this stuff out because that's what always people look at me like, well, how come you didn't know that blah, blah, blah? I'm like, you're right, I should have known, you know. So at that moment, I was like, okay, all right, I'm willing. And so at the time, I actually went 40 days, I guess it was. And the first thing I noticed was that my mind got really quiet. And I was like, whoa, oh my goodness, like, I had no idea that sugar was stirring up so much of my own madness. I'm sure that's what my sponsor was hearing on the phone every morning when I would call. But I couldn't hear it, you know. And so when that absence of it, I was like, wow, you know. But the really pivotal point came was at the end of those 40 days, I had some because I hadn't agreed to not have it forever, right? Only one day at a time for 40 days. And what happened that moment, I think, was probably one of the first sort of experiences of amends that I had, which was that as this sugar was going into my body, I actually felt it for the first time. And I had this sort of open moment of honest compassion and grace towards my body where I literally was like, oh my God, I am so sorry. Like, I had no idea what I was doing to me this whole time. And I promise you I'm not going to do that again. You know, and so from then I haven't gone back on that. And you know, this, and I say, you know, mending a relationship with my body because, again, as I said, when I came in, the problem wasn't the food; the problem was that I was fat. Just extended out of, you know, I had feelings very early on when I was young of being betrayed by my body, and so I just took my body to be the enemy, and that would explain a little bit about how I carried it around, kind of like a spare tire, you know, and made fun of it and did all kinds of things. You know, strangely enough, I was a dancer, so there was a part of me that really wanted to connect with it, but even that, it's amazing how disconnected one can be. So I think that certainly turned things for me as well. There was also some other things that surfaced for me that I hadn't dealt with that were really alarming, and that kind of put a little bit of a pause, and let me tell you, you can eat lots of things even if it's not sugar. But I remained abstinent. And then I think it was just after a year of abstinence, I was in a women's meeting, actually, and this woman was reading from the doctor's opinion. And it says in the doctor's opinion, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And there was something about it that just sort of struck me. And I remember, I think I'd lost about 25 pounds from not eating sugar, but I still had a lot of weight on me. And I just kind of went, well, what am I doing? Like, this is a Reader's Anonymous. So I'm either doing this or I'm not doing this. And it, you know, I think it was really at that point when, like it says in chapter 5, that if you have decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And I had done some, you know, I had begun some step work and stuff, and then things got kind of awkward between my sponsor and I, and that was kind of trailing. And I just had this new resolve, and so I got a new sponsor and just dove myself headfirst in and made this program the most important thing without exception. I started going to more meetings. I started committing my food instead of calling it in at the end of the day. My sponsor was pretty hardcore, but she, you know, she was a 100-pounder. She kept her weight off for, I don't know, like 16, 17 years. So I was just kind of like, okay, whatever you tell me to do. And I was a little scared of her, which is helpful. At least in the beginning. I don't recommend it long term, but, you know, and, you know, she had this whole list of things I had to do. She was like, you need to pray and meditate every day. And I was like, well, I can do the prayer thing, but meditate, like, I just fall asleep. She goes, I don't care. Get a timer set for 2 minutes. Your butt in a chair for 2 minutes, time goes off, you're done. I was like, oh, well, I can do that, you know. And so, like, 2 minutes became 5 minutes, became 7 minutes, became 15 to 20, you know. And, like, I mean, now it's just a part of my day every day. My formal meditation time, sitting my butt in that chair, is at least 5 minutes. Sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 20, depending on the day. And then often I have meditation times throughout the day. That prayer piece is still very much part of my recovery. I still commit my food. I do 10 steps. At the time, I upped my meetings from 3 to at least 5 a week. I've always held some kind of service position. And, you know, like, I went through the whole thing of, like, doing my 4-step, which, to be quite honest with you, I mean, it was interesting because one of the things that I can say for myself is I'm very determined / stubborn, you know, so, like, when I make a decision, it's a little hard for me to back down from it, for better or worse, and so when I made this decision, like, I made this decision, and so I was like, all right, we're full speed ahead, you know, and so You know, I would hear people like whisper about the four step. There were people who had spent like a year and a half on their four step, and like, good Lord, this sounds terrible. But I was just like, you know, my sponsor was just like, you just focus on today and what we're doing today. And right now we're on step two, so we're focusing, you know, so I wasn't like worried about that, you know. And to be honest with you, when it got to my four step, you know, my sponsor had me do like the structure of this in the big book, and just, you know, I really take to those words where it talks about that, like, this is a fact-finding, fact-facing proposition. It does not say shaming, blaming, you know, finding fault with yourself endlessly. It doesn't say any of those things, right? And, you know, so I did it like an inventory, and what I after a while, started laughing, to be honest, because what I saw was that I simply literally had, like, the same experiences with just different people in different situations, but I was the same. I was acting out of fear, I was acting out of selfishness, I was acting out of, it was mostly fear, that was probably my biggest thing. You know, they talk in literature about how it's like the boogeyman or whatever, my favorite is the termites that ceaselessly devour our minds. Yeah, that about describes it. And so, you know, I did that, and then I had some amends to make. That became later, but I did my fifth step, and that was just a relief. And, of course, it was the things I was most afraid to tell my sponsor about. She was like, oh, yeah, I've done that. Oh, okay. You know, like, oh, my God, you mean I'm not terminally unique? What are you talking about, you know? And then we got to work on the defects or defenses of character, she called them. And most of my amends were more like living amends to my family, and to, you know, my body, things like that, and the current relationships. Because I was someone who operated mostly out of fear, I did not act outwardly. I turned inward. You know, I leaned more on the depressive, morbid, self-obsessed side than I did the outward, like, you know, you're an a-hole, et cetera. For better or worse. Sometimes I think it would be easier for that end, but, that, you know, again, the grass is always greener, right? So I did those, and then I began on the 10th step, which, you know, which is kind of funny on some level, because they're like, just before you're about to get to the end, they go, oh, by the way, this is going to continue every single day. It's like, man, you know, just when you're like, the end is in sight, and then you're like, I got to keep doing this, you know? But the reason that we keep doing it is because it works, you know? It's like less about, like, this is the right way to live, or, you know, if you don't do it, you're living wrongly. It's like, this is what works for me. Like, something about these 12 steps just jive with my aura or my spirit or whatever you want to call it. Like, who knows? And so living them just makes life so much more doable. Because I don't know if you noticed, life is wacky and messy, and these days I feel like we're in a freaking pressure cooker, for heaven's sakes. It's like everywhere you turn, it's madness. And I'm just like, maybe that's because I work in healthcare. But but anyway, so, you know, it's like, it's intense, you know. And again, as somebody who has a tendency to feel things deeply and feel things in a large way and impactfully, like, it's a lot, you know. And I'm so grateful for these tools because they give me this reflection that I can see, like, A, where my thinking takes me when I don't keep it in check, when I'm, you know, not checking with my sponsor regularly, if, like, she was out of town for, like, a month or something like that. So I arranged to, like, have on my schedule to call fellows and stuff, because otherwise I'll be like, I'm fine, you know. I always think about, like, these little old ladies, like, totally drunk, they're like, I'm fine, leave me alone, you know, I can drive. You know, I mean, that's me. Like, left to my own devices, I'm like, I got it, you know, and I'm like falling over myself. Oh, yeah, you got it. I don't know what you got, but not that, you know. So it's like, you know, it's, I don't know, I feel like I'm doing a lousy job of explaining this. All I can say is that by living these steps, like, when I come across something that's uncomfortable, thankfully, because of my daily prayer and meditation practice, A, I don't automatically think, oh, that's it, I gotta go. Because that's usually my MO. Like, I gotta bolt, you know? Or I do a lot of, like, surveying of things going, okay, at what point am I gonna get to bolt or have to bolt or something like that. Like, you know, God bless any man that I've dated, you know, in the last, like, 20 years. It's usually, like, I live, like, I'm looking for, okay, do I need to cut now before he cuts? You know, like, you know, madness, right? So, which might explain why I'm still single. But anyways, you know, it's like those are the things that I get to look at, because, you know, that goes on too long. And I go, well, gee, you know, how come this doesn't seem to be working out? So my sponsor says, well, let's do an inventory on that. Darn it. So I might begrudgingly do it, but I do it. And I do my writing because it illuminates things to me. Because I can have things jumbling around in my head all the time. But something about putting the pen to paper, and for me it often is a pen to a physical paper, although typing or thumbing or something sometimes works if I need it. But like, it just sort of illuminates stuff. And so that's been a really powerful tool for me. In the beginning, especially, picking up the phone was just, I mean, that thing weighed 500 pounds. Because I didn't want to bother you. That was always the thing. And, you know, people just don't answer their phones or don't text back if they don't want to be bothered. So that goes there, goes that argument, you know. Or my other favorite one was that I was like, oh, I'm too much of a people pleaser. When that was really quite a fallacy, because the reality was is that the only reason deep down that I wanted to please you was so that you would say that I was okay. So it was really quite selfishly motivated, you know. So I get to look at those things, you know. And it's not always comfortable. It's not. But I don't have to eat over it. Like, I don't have to thank you. I don't have to say to myself, oh, you know, this is not going to end well. Like, what the reality is like it is most times, I do not know where it's going to end. And, you know, that's where, for me, the importance of a higher power comes in. Because I don't need a higher, I used to need a higher power that was going to rescue me from things, you know, like going to swoop in and take me out of this. Like, you know, I remember, like, in grade school when I hadn't studied for a test and I'd pray somehow that I'd get canceled or something like that. You know, that was the kind of higher power I wanted, like, to take me out of the consequences of my actions. A higher power that was going to magically not have the weight show up in my body after I'd just binge my brains out on God knows what. You know, that was me expecting a higher power to take me out of life circumstances. All while a higher power is like, I gave you this life. I want you to experience it. And I'm like, what? No, this isn't, I don't like this. Well, you know, and so what I find now, and I've had some really powerful experiences over the years, but the ones that are most impactful to me are the day-to-day, you know. Like, you know, there's some stuff that I'm working through right now on many different levels having to do with family and stuff. And, you know, in my meditation this morning, it just... the sense I got was as though God just said to me, I'm with you. And that's all I need to know. Like, because I, of course, want to know how it's going to turn out. And I'm already in, like, the planning stages of, like, this would be good, you know. And God's just like, let's just be with what is right now. And I'm like, ugh. You know. And that's the thing, too, is that God is one of the names that I use for my higher power. I have lots of different, you know, visions and ideas of my higher power. I love in Bill's story where it says, you know, if we are to survive, we must expand our spiritual life if we're to survive the trouble spots ahead. He doesn't say the catastrophes ahead, although it's helpful there too, but because it's, I don't know about you, it's the little stuff. It's the broken nail. It's the flat tire. You know, it's the like parking ticket. I'm like, I could have sworn I turned the tires. Dagnabbit, you know, that kind of stuff, right? That my higher power, in the places that I'm afraid to go to, right, that I think I'm going to be abandoned in, my higher, when I finally concede, you know, like I'm not going to run from this, my higher power is usually like already there in the stick of the mud going, oh, good, you're here. Let me show you what's going to be beautiful about this. And I'm like, what? You know, that's how I know it's not me. Because I wouldn't think of that, you know. And I'll just share the story to wrap up, just because I've mentioned a lot about my relationship with my body and stuff over the years, and that has definitely, you know, transformed a lot. I was coming out of the gym once years ago, and, you know, I'm, like, feeling like my skirt's too tight. I'm like, man, and I could hear the spinning about my body, and I was like, great. I want to go to work and focus on work, and my head's thinking about how my thighs feel fat or something, some other crazy idea, because clearly, in my perspective, my body's always been really spot on. And so I finally just, I literally, like, put my stuff in the trunk and went, all right, God, fine. how do you see my body, right? And in that moment, the word functional came to mind. And this is how I know it wasn't me. Because I was like, really? Functional? Like, I'm thinking, like, sexy, exciting, you know, like, athletic, functional, you know? And I was like, oh, right, yeah, my thinking not the same as yours. But I just sort of paused for a minute, and I was like, you're right. Like, my legs are walking, my lungs are breathing, you know, like, I see people coming out of the gym in, like, walkers and wheelchairs, and I think they're the biggest heroes ever. You know, like, I don't have to deal with that. Like, the system is flowing. Like, all these things that are very functional, and I take that entirely for granted, and I just was like, got it. Thank you, you know. And so, I mean, that's just one small example of, like, how I can sort of sense that, like, my higher power thinks differently than I do, and that's what I need to stay tapped into. And sometimes it's really just pausing and breathing and saying, show me how you see this. So hopefully something I said was helpful. I don't know if we have a couple minutes for questions, 5 minutes for questions. So, yeah. Sure. How do I negotiate crazy, overwhelming events happening in the world? I have several tactics. I mean, you know, when I become aware, and sometimes I can through, like, different habits I'll notice, I pick up, and I'm like, oh, I'm doing that thing, you know, where it's like a sign that I'm feeling overwhelmed. And then sometimes I can hear myself say, I just can't do this, you know. Pausing, literally I will pause, put my hand on my heart, take like 3 or 4 deep breaths will help. I usually try and do something to ground myself in the moment. You know, I'll look at my hands and be like, this is where my hands are. I'll feel my feet on the floor. I happen to have my own office because work is a good place to get overwhelmed. And I will close the door to my office and I will sit on the floor in a ball, you know, for a few minutes, try and do something nurturing for myself. You know, I'll ask God, like, where are you? You know, I'll call a friend. I'll text fellows and be like, hey, I'm feeling awkward and uncomfortable. I don't want to do this alone. I'll do writing. That's often helpful, whether it's typing or just taking out the pen to paper. Sometimes I have a big book in my office. You know, I'll pull out the literature. You know, sometimes I look at the clock and go, well, it's an hour till lunch. Like, I think I can do an hour, you know. Those kind of things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yeah.
Thank you so much. Uh-huh. You talked about, like, sort of, like, facing the world as if, like, you're preparing for battle, and in that you would anticipate people saying things, and so you would have your own things ready. Mm-hmm. And what things have helped you change so that you could be safely vulnerable and not have that old characteristic follow you?
Sure. So, me trying to brace the world versus, you know, look at it like, how can I be open to this and be vulnerable without having to wear armor? Is that kind of, if I understood your question correctly? Right. So, you know, one thing sometimes it's helpful for me to is remind myself that I have words today. Like, I use my body armor, literally pounds of to, like, protect me from the world. It never worked, but in my mind it did, right? So I don't have that. So, you know, sometimes it's just reminding myself that I'm the adult in the situation and that I have words. If I need them, I can always leave the situation. If there's something in particular, like, I know that's coming up ahead of time, I will start turning it over in my writing to God every morning, like, way in advance. And I try to envision, like, things going well, you know, so that I walk in perhaps a little bit less armored. And then I always imagine, like, my higher power at my back, you know, like, I'll never forget, I had this experience once where, I mean, it's sort of a minimal thing, but, like, again, the gym. I would have this, I realized that I felt very vulnerable walking in my workout clothes and all these men around and stuff like that, and I just felt this intense vulnerability. And there was this TV show character, this really tall, buff, like, football player dude who was, like, super cool or whatever, and I literally used to imagine him walking in with me, and when he'd see one of the guys looking at him, he'd be like, eyes back in your head, eyes back in your head. And I would, like, imagine him walk, and I know it probably sounds crazy, but it works, you know? And, yeah, there wasn't anything I was armoring against, but, like, if, like, that, if someone did approach me, whether it was a male or female or something, like, there's a part of me that sort of, like, tightened up or whatever. I couldn't just be open and friendly, as friendly maybe as I wanted to be to people, because I had to be, like, armored. And I realized it wasn't a way that I realized that I was armored, you know? And so when I was like, and I, it was actually kind of fun. It sort of reminded me to be like, eyes back in the head, you know? And I was like, that's right. He's got my back, you know? Because my higher power's got my back. So I hope that's helpful. Yeah. Better? All right. Well, thank you all for letting me be a service.